Go ahead and turn to Mark chapter 8. And as you make your way there, even though you do already know me, you've known me for almost 4 years now, I do want to do an introduction. Hello, my name is Ryan, and I'm a video game addict. And by the grace of God, now I have over 10 years of sobriety from the video gaming world. The game of choice for me back in the day was a video game series known of as Halo. And so the first game that came out was Halo Combat Evolved. Then there was Halo 2, Halo 3, Halo Reach, Halo ODST. There was a collection of them that came out basically every couple years. And so those games were my game of choice, all of them being futuristic first-person shooter games where you are this person who is saving the world from an alien invasion, from this, they're referred to in the game as Covenant, the Covenant. Just to give you a glimpse as to how much of a Halo gaming geek I was back in the day, this is an image that I photoshopped and altered while I was at work one night at the hospital. I basically turned my cat, Dixie, into a sidekick to Master Chief, Petty Officer John 117. So that's the main character in the game. And I thought, oh, I'm going to take Dixie. I'm going to put her in this little picture. Isn't she adorable? So that's how much. And there was more pictures. That's not the only one. There's quite a few others that I did at the time, but that's one of my favorites. So I was a big gaming geek. Over the course of about 8 years of this video game series, it absorbed more time and energy and money than I would care to admit, especially the amount of time playing these games over the course of those years. Whenever the next game would be released, like I said, about every 2 years they'd come out with the next one, and over the course of that time, I would take time off from work so I could have they have the release date, and I would take a day or two off so I could have two uninterrupted days where I could drink my game fuel version Mountain Dew. There was a special edition Mountain Dew that would come out. I would drink that Mountain Dew and I would stay up all hours playing numerous, even more hours than I would normally do because I would have these days off from work. So how did I get free from my gamer addiction? How did all of that fanboy fascination with a game come to an end? One word, marriage. Marriage changed everything. It changed everything because all of a sudden, upon entering into that covenantal relationship, my time was no longer my own. My money was not my own, and for the first time since leaving my parents' house to go to college, the steering mechanisms for all of the kinds of decisions you need to make in life, that decision-making process no longer revolved around just me and my desires. The specific day where I got my wake-up call that things needed to change is forever stamped in my memory. I was working night shift at the hospital. I came home in the morning, and Laura and I would have a little switcheroo that would happen. I'm coming home from work. She's on her way out the door. And so no sooner would she be gone than I would sit down and turn on the game console to play my game for 3, 4, or 5 hours before going to bed. Only on this particular day, I turned on the game console and there was no disc that was in the game system. I pushed the button, it opened up, it was empty. And immediately, as soon as I saw that it was gone, I knew what had happened. And if TikTok had been around back then in that moment when that empty disc tray popped out, the thing I would have heard in that moment would have been, oh no, oh no, oh no, 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 no. I knew I was in trouble. And if you're not familiar with TikTok, that's all right. There are a few who are. Lori had reached her breaking point. Far too many times she would come home at the end of the day of her work day to find me still sleeping, and she would wake me up. And I'd say, I need to sleep a couple more hours because I didn't go to bed till 1 or 2 because I was playing so many hours. Needless to say, on that morning, I went straight to bed. And when Lori came home from work, I was awake, I was alert, and I was ready to have a conversation. And the end result of that conversation was there would be a 1 week ban from playing the video game system. And during that week, we would work out whatever the new rules were going to be. So that way we could have a sustained and healthy marriage while having at least some game time without going overboard. And just a few short years after that, maybe a couple years after that, maybe it was a little bit more, but I ended up selling the Xbox console altogether. I kept the games. They're somewhere. I don't even know what box they're in. I kept the games, but I've never, ever gotten another console, so they're more of a keepsake thing than anything. It was the first major sacrifice in a process where I have been shaped and molded into the perfect husband that stands before you today. And as you laugh, go ahead and stand with me as I read from Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8, I'm going to read verses 31 through 38. He, Jesus, then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Go ahead and be seated. Now, at the point when Lori and I got married, we had only been together about a year and a half, a little bit under that. We dated for about 4.5 months before we got engaged, and then we got married about a year after that. For some people, that is a short amount of time, depending on people's standards. Some people get married really fast. Some people will date for years and then, or be engaged for years before they actually get married. After a year and a half together, Lori and I were still getting to know each other, and there was still plenty of left to learn from that moment where we said, "We do." The passage that we just read about Jesus and his disciples falls at a time when they've been together maybe about a year and a half, maybe 2 years together, getting to know each other deeper and deeper. At this point, they were beyond the relationship equivalent of just dating. So these disciples aren't just in the beginning stages. They've been following for a while. They're in a much more committed relationship. But despite their commitment to Jesus and despite their clear confession, which actually comes just in the passage before from Peter, despite the commitment and the confession that Jesus is the Christ, there was still so much for them to learn in terms of what a relationship with Jesus needs to look like. And so it's in this growing relationship context where the bold one in the group, Peter, he walks straight into a learning opportunity with Jesus. As Peter starts to rebuke Jesus, in my mind, I start to hear again, I imagine, the disciples in the background thinking, oh no, like what's Peter going to do? What's going to happen with this situation where Peter is rebuking Jesus? So that TikTok song starts playing as I read that. Peter is treading out onto some very thin ice, and he ends up getting the rebuke of a lifetime. If the words, "well done and good and faithful servant," are the words that every Christian want to hear, if that's the epitome of what we want to hear in our lifetime, then surely the words, "get behind me, Satan," is the absolute worst thing any follower of Jesus would ever want to hear. I cannot fathom there being a more strongly worded rebuke than that. And while we don't have the specific details of what Peter's rebuke looked like as he's addressing Jesus and rebuking him, there's plenty of reasons to believe that the core issue is a conflict between what Jesus had just said about his suffering and death and resurrection and what Peter was hoping to hear. Here Jesus was talking about his future suffering and rejection and death, while people like Peter and other people in the Jewish people community, they had visions of victory over Rome dancing in their heads, a false messianic hope that did not line up with what Jesus was actually going to do. In this teaching moment, Jesus was trying to reshape the expectations of his close disciples who had already been shaped and influenced by the dreams and desires of men before them. It seems like Peter stopped listening to Jesus early on and started preparing his rebuke because he must have missed the whole part about Jesus is going to be resurrected. He might have just heard the suffering and the death part and the rejection, and he already started not listening, which I've had happen before. You hear something you don't like, you get fixated on the part you don't like, and you miss out on what comes after. Peter was fixated on a different future reality. Peter desired something that Jesus was not offering. Peter wanted to go somewhere Jesus wasn't heading. Peter wanted Jesus to change his course and do things his way because he thought his way was better. Peter wanted his way so bad that he was willing to rebuke Jesus himself in order to get Jesus to line up with whatever Peter's selfish desires were. And it's for that very reason that he gets rebuked and put into the same category as Satan. And since I didn't preach last week with the ambassadors here, I was unable to preach on the temptation of Jesus in the desert. I know I've done it in other years at the beginning of Lent, but that's typically the passage from one of the Gospels that we have for the first Sunday. The situation where Jesus is dealing with 40 days of isolation and fasting and confrontation with the tormentor and deceiver, Satan. It's an encounter that provides helpful insight for this week's passage where Jesus rebukes Peter, referring to him as Satan. And so I'm going to read that account from the Gospel of Matthew. I'm going to read verses 1 through 11. And like I said, this is an account that is in other Gospels as well. Mark has a very abbreviated description of it, so I'm going to read the longer version in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the desert to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." Then the devil took him to the holy city and had him stand on the highest point of the temple. "If you are the Son of God," he said, "throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone." Jesus answered him, "It is also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. "All this I will give you," he said, "if you will bow down and worship me." Jesus said to him, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." Then the devil left him, and the angels came and attended to him. At the climax of that confrontation in the desert, what we have is an alternative path being proposed to Jesus. The proposal from the devil to Jesus is essentially this. So Jesus, you want to save the world. You want to reconcile the world back to God. You want to have the world. Well, here is a way to do it without having to die on a cross. There is another way. Just bow down and worship me, and I'll give it all to you. All the kingdoms of the world, all yours. I won't put up resistance. You can just have them. All you need to do is just bow down. Bowing down for a moment is simpler and less painful than slowly dying and agonizing death for hours on a cross. This way is better, and you can have it all right now. While Peter's desire for the acquisition of power for the people of Israel may seem innocent and harmless and even fully justified because of the heavy hand of Rome, his desire was no less demonic because his desire would require Jesus to bend toward the desires of Peter instead of being faithful to the desires of his heavenly Father. Religious people back then had very strong convictions about exactly what the Messiah would do when he arrived, and they were wrong. Very wrong. So wrong that they killed the actual Messiah because he didn't do what they fully expected him to do. Perhaps what the church needs today is a much needed reminder that strong convictions fueled by good intentions can still be horribly misguided. And trying to squeeze Jesus into our plans for the way we think God should do things, and doing that, we're essentially participating in a demonic activity. Harsh words to hear, but harsh words are exactly what Peter got trying to do what he did. The mind of men and the ways of men and the power of men is no substitute for the mind of the divine, the ways of the divine, or the power of the divine. And then Jesus continues on with this reshaping of his disciples, but by providing for them a model for them and for future generations of disciples. if anyone is going to be a disciple of Jesus, they must first deny themselves. Now, when it comes to being a disciple of Jesus, let's just say that this first step is a doozy. This giant step, in my opinion, is the step that differentiates between making a decision about Jesus and making a disciple for Jesus. When the gospel conversations center around heaven and hell and the acceptance of Jesus' offer of forgiveness being the key to unlocking a person's entry into heaven, what you may get as a result of that conversation are decisions for Jesus by people who have zero intention or felt need to become a fully devoted disciple of Jesus. Their eternal problem, as they understood it, may have been resolved, but they're not remotely called into a life of discipleship. That's exactly how you end up in a situation with a country full of people who don't gather, don't give, don't serve, don't pray, and don't ever read scripture. But if they ever have to answer a question about, are you a Christian, they will quickly and easily, without reservation or hesitation, check that box. A decision-making process where a person says yes to Jesus with their lips is not remotely the same thing as a discipleship-making process where a person says yes to Jesus with their lives. Unfortunately, the lives of far too many Christians are not reflective of the kinds of disciples Jesus has called them to be. The way in which they spend their time and energy and resources indicate in as many ways as possible that they are saying yes to themselves. A person who is taking seriously the call of Jesus to follow after him and go where he is going has to go through the painful process of saying no to themselves in the midst of a world that is constantly encouraging you and me to only and always say yes to ourselves. Say yes to yourself because you deserve it. Say yes to yourself because you need it. Say yes to yourself because you know what's best anyway. What's strange is that for me and my experiences, I wasn't the least bit selfish until I got married. For the first 25 years, I never once recalled ever having a problem, but for the last 17 years being married, it has been a battle. I'm sure some of you maybe have had that experience if you've been in that kind of a marriage relationship. The fact of the matter was, I wasn't dealing with selfishness when I was single, and that's probably the reason. I was just as selfish before, I just didn't realize it. There is something about being married that shines a big spotlight on our selfish tendencies. And few things can root out selfishness like a marriage relationship. So if you do choose to get married, if you've not been married before, prepare yourself for a wake-up call. Things that did not seem like a big deal prior to getting married can all of a sudden become an extremely big deal after married. And when it comes to being a disciple of Jesus, the discipleship process is intended to be every bit as intimate and invasive as a covenantal marriage relationship. In order to have a healthy and growing discipleship relationship with Jesus, you're going to have to learn how to submit to Jesus in all ways and at all times. Now, for that initial group of disciples gathered around Jesus, the ability to say no to themselves and submit to Jesus only became more complicated when they were told in advance, when Jesus spoke plainly about where he was heading. They were told in advance the path that Jesus was on involved persecution, suffering, and death. For the good part of a year, from the moment when Jesus first told them until he died on the cross, for every step of the way, they had to follow Jesus knowing that they were walking one step closer to an event they absolutely did not want to have happen. Not only regarding what was going to happen to Jesus and his livelihood, but their own. As the inner circle of followers, they were just as vulnerable as the leader they were following, but still they followed. Our human inclination is to avoid those sorts of things, a natural aversion to negative experiences. Nobody in their right mind wants to experience persecution. Nobody in their right mind wants to experience mocking and ridicule. Nobody in their right mind has a death wish to become a martyr. Nobody wants to carry a cross. And yet, as disciples of Jesus, that is precisely what we should always be prepared to endure. In no way should Christians ever be purposefully seeking out ways to experience those things as a way to somehow display their faith in Jesus. At the same time, neither should Christians be caught in compromising situations because they're fearfully trying to avoid even the slightest persecution knocking on their door. What good is societal safety if it results in a weak faith? Instead of carrying a cross, we can too easily get preoccupied with the efforts to secure our comforts. Meanwhile, the gospel message is spreading right now, today, in powerful ways in some of the most restrictive and dangerous of cultural contexts. While we may desire our comforts and appreciate our comforts as disciples of Jesus, what we need is to be willing to take up our cross. What good would it be for the church if it were to require a lifetime of religious freedoms if the process for holding on to them weakens its witness? We have an abundance of religious freedoms for which we can be thankful, but for the vast majority of Christians, they aren't even putting those freedoms to use. Faithful followers denying themselves and picking up their cross will have a far more powerful impact on the church than anything that happens in this world, culturally or legislatively. We can never be faithful followers if we are fearful of having to carry a cross. Jesus concluded this teaching moment about discipleship with a big promise, a promise that we didn't read initially, but I will read it now, and it's that next verse in Mark chapter 9, verse 1. It's actually a part of the passage, but they, for whatever reason, they chopped it off and put it in the next chapter. So Mark chapter 9, verse 1. And Jesus said to them, "I tell you the truth, some of you who are standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God come with power." 6 days after Jesus uttered those words, three of his disciples witnessed his transfiguration, a moment when Jesus' clothes became dazzling white and he had a conversation with Elijah and Moses. Around a year later, all of the disciples, minus Judas Iscariot, were witnesses to the power of resurrection and later on the power of Pentecost. And within the rest of their lifetimes, many of those who were disciples around Jesus in this moment, later on, they got to witness the gospel spreading powerfully throughout the world of their day. God's kingdom came with power. We are on our way toward Easter. 5 Sundays from today, we will be celebrating a moment when the power of God's kingdom was on full display in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The season of Lent is meant to prepare us so that we arrive at the cross and we arrive at the empty tomb, following the steps of Jesus and his disciples. My prayer is that we would gather together on Easter morning on April 4th as a people who have done the hard work of emptying ourselves so that we are empty vessels who are hungry and thirsty for what God has for us and not the things of this world, denying ourselves and saying no to ourselves so that every part of our lives can be a bold, confident yes to Jesus and his way. Yesterday, Paul and I were having breakfast, and as we were talking, he shared something that he shared before plenty of times, and I'm sure you've heard it as well. Years ago, when God took away his cigarettes, he didn't just take away the cigarettes, he took away the want to. The desire for something that had been a part of his life for decades was gone because God had done something. The discipline of denying oneself is not a natural or easy path to travel. It requires a complete transformation of our desires in order to be a faithful follower, disciple of Jesus. But thankfully, God is in the business of transforming the desires of people's hearts, resulting in a transformation of their lives. As we sing a closing song this morning, I would just ask for you to let the Spirit of God take a full inventory of your desires and of your life. Does your life reflect yes to Jesus or yes to you? I know for a good number of people, myself included, looking back over the course of my life, I would say that my life has been a mixture of that, saying yes to Jesus in some ways, but yes to myself in other ways. This morning, we need to know that Jesus asks for more than some sort of a mixture commitment, more than a mixture of yeses and nos. May we learn to do that in the days and weeks ahead, as we follow closer and closer to Jesus. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Go ahead and stand as we sing.